Well, good morning, everyone. Again, how wonderful to see how many of you are really steady through this session. You're really taking it on. You know, many of you doing all the sits or most of them. And I'm hearing from people, you know, who've commented in Doksan that even though you're at home, you know, with all the typical distractions of being at home and sometimes interactions with other people, that still something about this session structure is infusing, penetrating your life there at home. And so maybe this turns out to be a good way to do that, because maybe then the carryover and transition back into daily life won't be such a stark contrast, and that you'll take this session forward into your daily life in a way that will be more seamless. It's a word I like to use about our practice over the years, you know, when you keep doing these sessions, after a while, it just doesn't seem that different. Everyday life and session, it seems seamless, more so. Anyway, today's paramita is hope. And you will not find that in any list of paramitas, I don't think. Because it's not a word that comes up much in Buddhist thought and practice, and if it does, it's often in a negative sense. We are admonished not to even hope for enlightenment, right? To practice without a gaining idea, according to Suzuki Roshi. And among the Tibetan Lojong slogans and teachings, there's one that tells us to abandon all hope of fruition or reward. So, in a schema where desire is the cause of our suffering, that makes sense, doesn't it? No hope, no disappointment. Right? Some of us know that. Some of us actually have incorporated a kind of message about that, you know. If I'm too hopeful, I'm too, you know, get into too invested in this relationship or this practice or this job, then I'll just be disappointed. So I won't invest. I won't engage. Right? No hope, no disappointment. Thus, no suffering. We want to avoid that. Or we're always hooking ourselves into hopes over and over again. But our Western way of thinking has also conditioned us to think of hopelessness as a kind of hell realm. Abandon all hope, ye who enter here, says the inscription on the gate to Dante's Inferno, right? If we don't have hope, how can we face the suffering in our own hearts and all around us in the world? The American poet Wendell Berry writes about this. In the destruction of the world, in our lives, that drives us half insane and more than half, to destroy that which we were given in trust, how will we bear it? It is our own bodies that we give to be broken, our bodies existing before and after us in clod and cloud, worm and tree, that we, driving or driven, despise in our haste to die. Our country spent in shining cars speeding to junk, to have lost wantonly the ancient forests, the vast grasslands in our madness, is our madness, the presence in our very bodies of our grief. So I think there are those among us who can relate to those feelings that Wendell Berry expresses. And the great activist and teacher, Joanna Macy. Wave your hands if you know that name. Yeah, most of you do. Joanna Macy pioneered work that she called despair and empowerment work, kind of workshops where she really invited people into a safe space to express their grief about the state of the world, particularly in regards to environmental destruction, but also war and social disorder. She started out as a peace activist. And her basic premise was that we need to be able to fully grieve, fully feel our feelings about the state of the world in order to free the energy to act and respond, in order to have any kind of hope. And as a longtime Buddhist practitioner, she called upon the Dharma in her work, not always explicitly, but it thoroughly informed her work. So we could easily call upon our Bodhisattva vows to support us in facing suffering as it is in the world, and to respond to it with wisdom, compassion, and skillful means. If not hope, what will help us? Or is there a way to reconfigure hope that is congruent with our practice and our understanding of the Dharma? I'm sure I'm not the only one wondering about hope these days. I recently attended some online events at the Vancouver Writers Festival, and the theme of hope came up repeatedly. And a lot of people expressed a mixture of anxiety and hope because about the impending U.S. elections. Not quite sure how to feel, right? Just listen to some of the titles of books that have been published just in recent years. I'm just going to read out the titles. I'm not going to tell you, worry about the authors. Radical Hope, Ethics in the Face of Cultural Devastation. Active Hope, How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy. Intrinsic Hope, Living Courageously in Troubled Times. And hot off the press, two books that were featured at the Writers' Festival. One, Commanding Hope, The Power We Have to Renew a World in Peril, by Thomas Homer Dixon, who is the director of the Cascade Institute, kind of a think tank in Victoria, research center, addressing humanity's converging environmental, economic, political, and technological crises. And another book by Victoria writer and educator Ellen Kelsey called Hope Matters, Why Changing the Way We Think is Critical to Solving the Environmental Crisis. The people writing these books are not in denial. They know as much or more than any of us about the statistics, the models, and the threats to our environment and life on Earth. But they argue that fear alone is not an effective way of motivating people to care and act. Act in positive ways. Many activists seem to feel that they need to scare people into changing their behavior around environmental and climate change issues. Maybe you've engaged in some of that yourself, trying to wake up a friend or a relative. But it doesn't go very far, does it? Evoking fear. How many of you have found yourself engaged in that newly coined word, doom scrolling? Wave your hand if you, and maybe you don't know the word yet, but You know, it's like flipping through all the bad news on your device, right? Yeah. How many of you have renounced? Remember Michael talked about renunciation? How many of you have renounced doom scrolling during this session? Hold up your hands so you can see each other. Yeah. Not so easy, is it? Not so easy. It's addictive. But when you get hooked into a lot of that, doom scrolling, how does it make you feel? Would you say it's empowering? Would you say it's encouraging? Not so much. Not so much. Research has been done on this. Oh, they got to keep all those grad students busy. Research seems to indicate that fear mainly tends to create feelings of powerlessness, paralysis, dissociation, or a kind of defensive cynicism. We hear some of that in the media. Ellen Kelsey, who wrote this book, Hope Matters, can you see it? Does a lot of public speaking about environmental issues and climate change, and she often asks her audience to say how they're feeling about these issues. And here's what she says. When I look out at these audiences, I see bright, healthy, relaxed-looking people who have somehow found the time to come to a public lecture. Yet their answers convey an unnerving level of grief and despair. Scared, hopeless, depressed, numb, apathetic, overwhelmed, guilty, paralyzed, helpless, angry, call out the voices. Whether the room is filled with adults, university students, or kids as young as grade 3, whenever I ask, the words remain the same. She has come to believe that we have to deeply question the way we're receiving the bad news about the environment and to expand the story that we're willing to tell ourselves. Remember, throughout this practice period, we've been talking about using these practices of the paramitas to expand the stories. You know, we live inside these contracted stories, to expand the stories. And this does not mean denial in any way. It's just acknowledging that because that the way information comes to us is skewed in the media, we are missing parts of that larger picture. We are missing messages of creative, constructive, technologically sophisticated, and elegantly simple work that is being done all over the world, to make a difference. But we don't find out about that unless we make an effort. Apparently, we humans need not only the facts, but stories of connection, resourcefulness, and resilience to feel connected, encouraged, and empowered. Makes sense, doesn't it? Kelsey had also observed that children are full of interest and enthusiasm for the natural world if they're given a chance to get acquainted with it, and that they respond to stories of possibility and creative solutions to environmental problems and want to help. But our adult hearts and minds have become hardened and shielded to what is so painful. But underneath that, our hearts are no different from those children's open hearts and curious minds. This kind of hope is not naive optimism. It's not a cheerful Pollyanna attitude that everything will turn out fine, but a clear-eyed view that can hold complexity and uncertainty and the possibility of great suffering without being paralyzed, without turning away. And we need to actively engage in finding wider sources of information that will give us that big view, that long view. and that will encourage and empower us right in the middle of the multiple crises we are living through. Over the past almost a year, I think, Mountain Rain's Engaged Buddhist Practice Group has been assembling these kinds of resources. Not just, all the, in addition to the information we need to know about damage and crisis, also the work that's being done. The group has been posting these links on the webpage, the Engaged Buddhist Practice webpage on the Mountain Rain website. So take a look sometime and get your own set of sources outside the mainstream media to tell you about what you care about. It's remarkable to me how congruent the perspectives of some of these writers are with a Dharma perspective. Roshi Joan Halifax of Upaya Zen Center in New Mexico talks about wise hope. She says, if we look at hope through the lens of Buddhism, we discover that wise hope is born of radical uncertainty, rooted in the unknown and the unknowable. Yeah, so there's that humility of knowing how much we don't know and being willing to learn. I was poking around online a while back as I mused on this question of Buddhism and hope. I encountered a poignant inquiry on a Theravadan Buddhist website called Dhamma Wheel. And it was a message signed Dhamma Kid. This is what Dhamma Kid wrote. I'm wondering if the Buddha has any teachings or quotes on the topic of hope. Is hope necessary for Buddhist practice? In what way? I ask because recently I find myself without much hope for a lot of things. This mostly has to do with my depression, which has been treated a few times. But I also find myself being uncharacteristically hopeless about society in general. Before this summer, I spent the last 4 years working in various social justice, equal rights campaigns on campus, and was a very idealistic and hopeful person. I had faith in people, in society, that we would eventually find a better way to manage ourselves and the environment. But recently, I don't really have that type of faith anymore. Signed, Dhamma Kid. I wonder how many of you may have had a somewhat similar experience in that maybe you throw yourself enthusiastically into a cause or a workplace full of passion and hope for change, only to find that 4 or 5 years down the road, not much has changed. And if anything, the state of the world seems even worse, and that even within the movement or the workplace, people are bickering and exhausted. And you're just scraping by financially because you haven't been pursuing a lucrative career in information technology. So maybe you get a new job, or you go off to a Zen monastery, or you sink into a depression or addiction, or maybe you hide behind clever cynicism, leaving behind your naive, youthful idealism. I'm glad that Dhamma Kid is aware of their despair and is reaching out with that question. The trouble is we have this tendency to boomerang between our desires and hopes and fear and despair. It's hard to walk that middle path. And all too often numbing out is the option for avoiding the extremes. Greed, hatred, and ignorance, the three poisons, neatly sum up the causes of our human suffering and discontent. We desire what is pleasant to us, we are averse to what is unpleasant, and we turn away from what we just don't want to deal with, we don't want to look at. It's hard enough to look honestly at our own, let alone our collective systemic greed, hatred, and ignorance. in the face of the entrenched and very powerful forces driving much of our human behavior, it is easy to feel overwhelmed, discouraged, helpless. Helpless, hopeless, and alone, and deeply anxious. A lot of people talk about generalized feeling of anxiety in recent weeks and months. Not necessarily sparked by a particular thing, but it's just in the atmosphere and in our bodies. I would venture to say or speculate that much of our society's frantic efforts at distraction, you know, staying plugged in to the latest device, Netflix binges, working 10-hour days, you name it. That these can be ways of avoiding those feelings of anxiety and powerlessness. But when we deeply take up this practice of staying awake and present to our own experience, moment to moment, we begin to see that it's not a matter of my greed, hatred, and ignorance, but rather that our delusion is inextricably interwoven with the karma of all humanity. And so is our liberation. In the Dharma, sure enough, the personal is political, and the political is personal. Remember that slogan, the personal is political, from the feminist years? And this very reality, that the personal is political and the political is personal, that we are totally embedded in our human culture, karma, is grounds for a variety of hope. The law of karma means that everything we do counts, as individuals and together, and flows forward. Actually flows outward and onward without limit. Without limit. One little thing that you do, you know, that kind of, it's a bit of a cliche now, the butterfly effect, the butterfly wing fluttering on one side of the world and a hurricane happens on the other side. So it's a little bit silly, but the point is that there is no limit. We have many choice points in our lives, whether to speak and act in a beneficial or harmful way. And to the extent that we bring awareness to our own experience, we are able to notice those choice points and make conscious choices, rather than being governed by default habit patterns. This is not hope in a conventional sense. I hope the weather's good for the weekend. I hope I get the job. I hope you feel better soon. This is a profound, radical hope. And this kind of hope is more akin to two qualities that we do cultivate in Buddhist practice, aspiration, or vow, and faith. And those are the next two Michael's going to talk about. The great Czech poet, playwright, who led the Velvet Revolution and became the first president of the Czech Republic, Václav Havel, describes hope in a similar way. The kind of hope I often think about, especially in situations that are particularly hopeless, such as prison, which is an experience he had, I understand above all as a state of mind, not a state of the world. Either we have hope within us or we don't. It's a dimension of the soul. It's not essentially dependent on some particular observation of the world or estimate of the situation. Hope is not a prognostication or prediction. It's an orientation of the spirit, an orientation of the heart. It transcends the world as it is immediately experienced and is anchored somewhere beyond its horizons. And I don't think that means necessarily in terms of goal, but as we said, the realization that our reality is boundless. Hope, in this deep and powerful sense, is not the same as joy that things are going well, or willingness to invest in enterprises that are obviously headed for early success, but rather an ability to work for something because it is good, not just because it stands a chance to succeed. He could be talking about our practice, couldn't he? So could the American Trappist monk, writer, and mystic Thomas Merton, who was also an activist for peace and social justice. He wrote, "Do not depend on hope of results. You may have to face the fact that your work will be apparently worthless and even achieve no result at all, if not perhaps results opposite to what you expect. As you get used to this idea, you start more and more to concentrate not on the results, but on the value, the rightness, and the truth of the work itself. You gradually struggle less and less for an idea and more for specifics." He says specific people, but I think he means specific in the sense of abstract, not abstract. In the end, he says, it is the reality of personal relationship that saves everything. And I don't think he's talking about personal relationship in a narrow sense here. He's saying our motivation must become less abstract and more relational, more specific. I suspect that the range of Merton's relational specificity was very wide and inclusive. I think he had what Sharon Salzberg, the Vipassana teacher, calls a heart as wide as the world. For our relational capacity to be from a heart that's as wide as the world. When the boundaries of our narrow self-interest break open, our field of caring and connection becomes boundless. So we've identified a couple of Dharma truths that support this reconfigured sense of hope. The truth of karma, cause and effect, which empowers us to take responsibility for how we live in the world, and the truth of non-self, or boundless self, self in relationship. We could add the truth of impermanence. Seeing deeply into the truth of impermanence gives us a spacious perspective over time and helps us to be less attached to our short-term agenda for change and wanting it to go exactly the way we want it to. You know those protest march chants. What do we want? Fill in the blank. When do we want it? Now. Right? Understanding impermanence helps us to cultivate the paramita of patience so that we are good for the really long haul. And that's what we're in right now. Right? The writer and activist Rebecca Solnit has to say this about hope and change. Hope just means that change is all that is certain and that what we do might matter. It relies on uncertainty and ephemerality, on the long track record of movements and individuals who seemingly come out of nowhere, and make a difference somewhere, on the changes that would have been preposterous as predictions, but look inevitable in hindsight. Despair is in some ways a form of certainty, mostly that the future extends coherently from whatever is most grim in the present. In despair, we're actually fixing on a kind of belief. And political depression, like personal depression, seems to bring the same kind of self-absorption, stuck in the here and now in all the worst ways, as though this time will last forever, as though this is the only place on earth. How can we see impermanence as freeing? This is a quote from her book, Hope in the Dark, Untold Histories, Wild Possibilities, which she wrote in response to her own bout of despair quite some time ago now, in the wake of the outbreak of the Iraq War in 2003. She had been intensely involved in the worldwide peace movement in the preceding months. So she found it necessary to look back at that time and tell the story of the arrival of the millennium in a more comprehensive way than what just despair and defeat would dictate. We humans have a tendency to emphasize stories about what is a threat to our self-identity, our lives, and what belongs to us. We take the one person who criticizes us much more seriously than the 10 who praise and appreciate us. Do you ever notice that? How the one criticism stings. This is true then on the collective level as well as the individual. Right? We have this inherent bias towards threat. Because it's life-threatening. We perceive it as life-threatening, right? So we have to expand the story. Solnit retells the story of the approach of the millennium. She includes the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, the Chiapas uprising of the Zapatistas in 1994, the shutting down of the World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle in 1999. That's starting to seem like kind of distant, isn't it? All that, the massive pause after 9/11 on the brink of a different possibility of response, and the upwelling in the ensuing months of the largest anti-war movement the world has ever seen. So she tells that story of the turning of the millennium. And she makes the case, these are her words, that our history of victories and the degree of transformation of our societies for the better is far more profound than we ordinarily remember, or that standard histories record, or that the media reports, right? So it makes me wonder, you know, looking at how she told the larger story of the turning of the millennium, how might the story of this year be told 20 years from now? Already, you know, the turning of the millennium seems kind of far away. 20 years ago. What's 20 years from now? Can we imagine a bigger, wider story for this year? How can we contribute to that story unfolding? Solnit says, change takes place in a more protracted, circuitous, and surprising ways than is often acknowledged, so that disappointment is often based on the wrong expectations or calculations. This is something we can actually observe in our own lives, not just on that large scale. We often get snagged on our overwrought expectations or stuck in our narrow agendas and not realize that we can step outside that agenda and see that actually maybe what's happening is something we can get on board with. Hope, she says, again, this is Solnit, hope is not about what we expect. It is an embrace of the essential unknowability of the world, of the breaks with the present, the surprises, or perhaps studying the record more carefully leads us to expect miracles. Not when and where we expect them, but to expect to be astonished, to expect that we don't know. It kind of links up with the paramita of miracles from last night, huh? And there, in that not knowing, again, we find hope for action. This is sometimes called hope in the darkness. The darkness of the unknown, which need not be terrifying, but rather rich with possibility. Derek. I got too many markers in my little poetry books here. There's another Wendell Berry poem. I might not be able to find it. Well, if I find it later, I will share it with you. Ah! No, that's not it. So, there we have wise hope again, engaged hope. And ironically, one of the greatest obstacles to wise hope is perfectionism. This is Rebecca Solnit again. You can tell I like her writing. Feels like I'm getting her to do the work for me. She says it so well. Perfection is a stick with which to beat the possible. Perfectionists can find fault with anything, and no one has higher standards in this regard than radicals. Their grumpiness is often the grumpiness of perfectionists who hold that anything less than total victory is failure. A premise that makes it easy to give up at the start or to disparage the victories that are possible. Most victories will be temporary or incomplete or compromised in some way, and we might as well celebrate them as well as the stunning victories that come from time to time. So there was a recent victory, you know, that was incomplete, still is incomplete. Maybe not compromised, but certainly there were many obstacles, and those obstacles remain. But we can celebrate it. We can celebrate it and go on. We live in an imperfect world fraught with human cruelty and injustice. But in Buddhist cosmology, the heavenly realm is a static place. Place of complacency, not conducive to awakening. We need to be able to see the moments of heaven in the midst of hell and the moments of hell in the midst of heaven. F. Scott Fitzgerald once said, "The test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function." One should, for example, be able to see that things are hopeless and yet be determined to make them otherwise. So Zen practice really equips us for this, right? You know, holding the simultaneous perspectives of the absolute, of oneness, and the relative, of the everyday particularity, which we chanted this morning, right? Harmony of difference and equality. In the light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark there is light, but don't see it as light. We need to find a way not to be snagged by our ideas about victory and defeat, but to make our bodhisattva practice in the world a daily practice. Rebecca Solnit points to the openness of recent social change movements around the world to participation, improvisation, celebration, artistic expression, to enacting the vision of change that we are working towards, embodying, you know, our practice. And this parallels what Zen Master Dogen calls the oneness of practice and enlightenment. Enlightenment not being some distant, unattainable state without lifetimes of diligent practice, but right here in any moment of being fully alive and awake in this world, letting the bonds of self clinging go. Rebecca Solnit suggests that when the revolution is a practice of ongoing creative engagement in every aspect of daily life, she says, hope is no longer fixed on the future. It becomes an electrifying force in the present. She might as well be talking about our practice of awakening. It's just that radical. The American novelist Barbara Kingsolver explains it in a very earthy way. She says, I have been thinking a lot lately about the difference between being optimistic and being hopeful. I would say that I'm a hopeful person, although not necessarily optimistic. Here's how I would describe it. The pessimist would say, it's going to be a terrible winter. We're all going to die. The optimist would say, oh, it'll be all right. I don't think it'll be that bad. The hopeful person would say, maybe someone will still be alive in February, so I'm going to put some potatoes in the root cellar just in case. Hope is a mode of resistance, a gift I can try to cultivate. So let's cultivate hope in our garden of paramitas. Someone might be alive in February. Let's let our practice of awakening, meeting each moment of our lives just as it is, let that kindle our aliveness. Let's know what we care about and speak our cares to each other and join together to act in whatever ways, small or large, that we can with wisdom, compassion, and skillful means. Our little lives are short, but we're in this together for the long haul. I'll say it once more, everything we do matters. So be kind, be patient, take heart. Thank you everyone for your practice and your kind attention.